This is Audible.
Scholastic Audio presents A Web of Air, the second book in the Fever Crumb series by Philip Reeve, read by Jenny Agutter. Chapter 1. Thursday's Child. Something was upsetting the angels. Usually at that hour, Arlo found dozens of them fluttering along the beach, scuffling their little bony hands through the mounds of drying seaweed to scare up crabs and sand fleas, which they caught and crunched in their toothy beaks. Most mornings, when he came in sight, dozens of them would start calling to him, their scratchy voices rising above the boom of the breaking surf.
Arlo! Snacks! Snacksies!
But that morning, the beach was silent and deserted. The tide had gone a long way out, and even the sea was quiet. Despite the heat, the sky was grey and had a strange look, as if the clouds had somehow curdled. Glancing up as he climbed his secret path onto the island's high rocky spine, Arlo thought this was what a fish might see if it looked up from inside the sea at the underbelly of the waves. His grandfather had grumbled that a storm was on the way. He scrambled up onto the island's summit, hoping to find cooler air and some angels to talk to. No one had time for him at home that morning. His mother was busy with the new baby, who was grizzling at the heat. Father was down at the shipyards, overseeing the work on Senor Leonida's new copper-bottomed schooner. Grandfather was at work in his study. Arlo didn't really mind. He preferred it up here, on his own. He'd always been a solitary, thoughtful boy. Following goat tracks through the gorse and heather, he approached the old, abandoned watchtower, which stood on a crag high above the harbour. From there he could look down into his family's shipyards. The new schooner lay like a toy in the large pen with other ships, Zebex and barkentines, and fine, fast sloops, built or half-built, in the lesser pens around it. Offshore the sea was scabbed with islands, but most of them were just barren rocks and angel rookeries, none as big or pleasant as Thursday Island. Away in the east, dark against the hazy shoreline of the mainland, squatted a conical crater. Smoke hung above it in the hot and strangely windless air, making it look as if it were getting ready to erupt. But it was no volcano. It had been formed in the long ago by some powerful weapon of the ancients, and the smoke came from the chimneys of the city that was built on its inner slopes. Maida, at the world's end, was the finest city in the world, and Arlo's family were its finest shipwrights, even if they did choose to live outside it, safe and private, here upon their island. He left the tower and climbed a little higher, intent on the tiny white specks that were the sails of fishing boats scattered around Maida's harbour mouth, and suddenly, as he reached the stones at the very top of the island, angels were soaring past him, their wide white wings whizzing and soughing as they tore through the air. A few of them recognized him, and he heard them call his name.
Arlo! Arlo! Wave!
So he waved, and they swung past him and out across the sea and back again, following curious zigzag flight paths as if they were trying to elude a predator. He glanced up, expecting to see a hawk or sea eagle hanging in the sky's top, but there was nothing, only those curdled clouds. He watched the angels for a while, trying to understand the way they tipped and twitched their wings to steer themselves. He pulled two leaves from a bush, found a forked twig of heather on the ground, and spent a little while constructing an angel of his own. He climbed onto a rock and threw it like a dart, and just for a moment its leaf wings spread to catch the air, and he thought it would fly, but it only fell. He lost interest in it before it even hit the ground, and looked away, westward, sensing something. Above all the black stacks and wherries, where the angels roosted, fretful clouds of them were twisting, turning the sky into a soup of wings. And beyond them, far off across the ocean, something had gone wrong with the horizon. Just then his favourite of the angels, the fledgling he called Weasel, landed beside him like a feather football. Arlo groped in his pocket for the crusts of stale bread he always brought with him, expecting Weasel to ask for snacks. But Weasel just made the same noise the others were all making.
Wave!
What? What's that, Weasel?
Wave! Come!
Weasel had more words in him than the others of his flock. He was learning not to let his bird voice stretch them out of shape. Grandfather said he was a throwback, almost as clever as the angels of old. He hopped from foot to foot and fluffed out his feathers and waggled his fingers in alarm, trying to make Arlo understand.
Wave, come, here! Danger! Big, big!
A wave, said Arlo, and looked again to the west from where a sudden wind was blowing. The horizon heaved and darkened. It swelled into the sky. Arlo listened. He could hear the hammers at the shipyards and the maids laughing in the house, and a distant sound that lay beneath it all, so vast and low that he wondered if it had always been there. Perhaps this was the noise the world made, turning around on its axis. But how had he never noticed it before?
Wave!
Screamed all the angels, and the sky flexed and shuddered, and Arlo understood. And then he was up and running. But how can you hope to outrun the horizon? After 10 paces he looked back and saw it clearly, a blade of grey water sweeping toward him over the face of the sea. It hit the outermost of the islands and there was a brief explosion of spindrift, and they were gone. And the wave came on, white and broken now, like a range of snow-covered mountains uprooted and running mad.
Wave!
He started to shout, just like the angels, as brainless as an angel in his terror. But who could hear him above the world-filling voice of the sea? He ran and tripped and fell and rolled and scrambled through the heather, down out onto the crag where the watchtower stood. 100 feet below him, the men in the shipyards were setting down their tools, standing, starting to run. From down there, he doubted they could see the wave, but they must be able to hear it. There was a smack like thunder as it struck the cliffs at the island's western end. White spray shot high into the sky and dropped on Arlo as a storm of rain. The weight of it punched him back against the stones of the watchtower wall. It plastered him there, and past him rolled a wave, or part of it, a fat, foam, marble snake of sea, squeezing itself through the straits that separated Thursday Island from its neighbours, lapping at the high crag where he stood. And when it was gone, the thunder and the spray and the long, shingle-sucking, white-roaring, hissing rush of it, he peeled himself from the tower's side, already knowing what he was going to see. Or rather, not see. Because his home, his family, the shipyards and the ships they had held were all gone, swiped aside by the sea's paw and dragged down into drowning deeps so bottomless that not a spar or a splinter or a scrap of cloth would ever surface. And he was alone on Thursday Island with the angels. Chapter 2. In Maida, at the World's End. In the long lilac twilight of a midsummer's evening, Ruin Solent ran between the land barges, which were parked up on the fairground behind the busy harbour. In London, where Ruin came from, these barges were called Summertown, and he'd looked forward every year to their arrival. Now he was a part of their convoy, a traveller himself, and he knew that their proper name was Bargetown, and that they kept rolling through every season, not just summer, carrying their shops and entertainments all over Europa, even here, to Maida at the World's End. The fairground where they had parked was a weed-speckled, empty lot between tall warehouses, swept clear of buildings by the great wave that had struck the World's End nearly 10 years before, the same wave that broke over Thursday Island and destroyed the shipyards there. But Ruin was only 10, and he had arrived in Maida just that afternoon. He had never heard of Thursday Island. He had heard people talk about the giant wave, the Ondra Dilmai, they called it in these parts. But it was an unreal and storybookish thing to him, just another colourful disaster out of history. Anyway, Ruin had more immediate disasters to worry about. His land barge, the travelling theatre called Persimmon's Electric Lyceum, was supposed to raise its curtain at sundown, and already the sky was freckled with the first pale stars, and in the steep streets of the city the lamps were being lit. Sir Ruin was rushing, weaving, burrowing his way through the crowd of sightseers and shoppers that swirled between the barges. Behind him he could hear his friends, Max and Fergus, bellowing through their brass trumpets to attract an audience.
"Take your places at the Lyceum! Take your places for Neil Strongarm or the Conquest of the Moon!"
Some of the people Ruin was pushing past looked interested and started to make their way toward his barge, but Ruin just ran even faster away from it. He knew that without him and his fleet feet and bony elbows that the show could not begin.
"Excuse me,"
he hollered as he jabbed and ducked his way past a fat, silky merchant. "Scusi!
Scusi-moi!"
he shouted, bulldozing onward. He was a much-travelled boy and knew a little of all the languages of Europa. He was as thin as a pipe-cleaner sculpture and as brown as a hazelnut, with a dandelion clock of sun-blonde hair and a sudden white grin that helped people forgive him when he bumped into them. Maiden fisherfolk in their temple-going best looked down and made way for him. Pretty ladies smiled sweet smiles as they stepped aside to let him pass.
"Excuse me,"
he kept on shouting.
"Excusez-moi!"
All afternoon the barges had been crawling into Maida, edging their way out along the zigzag causeway that tethered the crater to the mainland, squeezing through a cleft in its wall into the city. The Lyceum had been one of the first to arrive, and while her crew was busy setting out the stage and seating, other barges had parked up all around her. Not just the familiar ones that had been travelling with Barge Town all season, but a second convoy too, come down from Nowhere and the Cap Still Naughty, to set up shop here at the World's End. Ruin recognised one of the newcomers, an old blue travelling market called the Rolling Stone. It was such a recent arrival that its engines were still cooling, and sea spray from the causeway crossing dripped like rain off its wheel arches and its underparts. But its merchants had already set out their wares, and a queue of eager shoppers was edging up its gangplank. Ruin scurried up past them to the turnstiles at the top, where one of the men on duty tried to stop him squirming underneath, but the other said,
"Oh, let him through, Alan. It's only that Solent boy from Persimmon's Theatre."
He waved a thank you, running out onto the market deck. It was crammed with stalls and little cluttered shops, already busy with shoppers under its fluttering awnings. A woman blocked Ruin's way, holding up a bolt of cloth against herself and asking her bored husband his opinion.
"You ought to go and see the play, Master,"
Ruin told him, swerving past.
"It starts in a couple of minutes."
And right on his cue, his words were answered by a distant farting of brass bugles from the far end of Barge Town, announcing that the Lyceum was preparing to raise its curtains. Ruin knew that by now the audience would have gathered in front of the apron-shaped stage that extended from the theatre's stern. The first night in a new town always meant a big crowd. The seats would be full, and people would be sitting on the ground too, or standing at the back, or watching from the windows of nearby buildings. Max and Fergus would be going around with their cash satchels, selling last-minute tickets. The closed curtains would look calm and classy, and give no hint of the panic boiling behind them, where Ambrose Persimmon would be trying out his big stage voice.
"Me, me, 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 me,"
while Alison Froy helped him into his first act costume. Fern, Ruin's small sister, would be sneezing in the fog of face powder that filled the ladies' dressing rooms as she haired this way and that among the racks of hanging gowns on frantic errands for frantic actresses. Mistress Persimmon would have lost her tiara as usual, and Lilibet would be sobbing that she had put on weight and couldn't fasten the hooks and eyes on the back of her bodice. And all that effort, all that fuss and worry would be for nothing if Ruin didn't make it back within the next 2 minutes. At the untidy sternward end of the market deck was a stall called Squinter's Old Tech Improbabilities. Its owner, Mort Squinter, was haggling about something with a large man in a broad-brimmed hat and travel-stained blue cloak. Ruin waited a bit, bouncing from foot to foot with impatience, then interrupted.
"If you please, Master Squinter, we need some copper wire."
"Ain't you got none of your own?" asked Squinter, squinting down at him.
"We did have Master Squinter, but AP used it to make his costume more magnificent, and he forgot to tell us, and now there's none left, and a fuse has blown, and we must do the show in darkness unless you can help us.
Mistress Persimmon said you'd be sure to help.
Mistress Persimmon had said nothing of the sort, but everyone on the Lyceum knew that Mort Squinter was in love with their leading actress, kept her portrait under his pillow, and kissed it each night before he went to sleep. Ruin guessed that his request might go down better if it seemed to come from her. "Well," said the love-struck Squinter, blushing as he rummaged through the stacks of tiny wooden drawers behind his counter.
"It's not cheap, your actual copper, not nowadays when so much is shipping north to London, but of course, if it's for Laura Persimmon."
He looked to his other customer, hoping the man wouldn't lose interest and wander off to try some other stall while he was busy with Ruin.
"Beg pardon for the interruption, sir. This boy's from Persimmon's Lyceum, at the far end of the line. We travelled with them all last season. They have a wench from London who arranges their electric lamps and stage effects and such. And there's never a performance goes by without this lad of hers comes scavenging for some piece of tech or other. It's not as if Laura Persimmon ain't radiant enough without old-fangled light shining on her."
"She knows the secrets of electricity, then, this Londoner?" the traveller asked. "What is her name?"
Squinter, still nosing in those drawers, scratched his head and said,
"She's called Fever Biscuit. No, Fever Crumble."
"Fever Crumb," said Ruin firmly,
and the traveller turned and stared down at him with a look that was difficult to fathom.
"Aha!"
said Master Squinter triumphantly, holding up a scrap of cardboard around which a few inches of wire was wound. Ruin snatched it from him with a mumbled thank you and was gone, vanishing back into the crowd before Squinter could finish shouting,
"What about payment?"
"Ask AP after the show,"
Ruin yelled over his shoulder. Squinter shouted something else, but by then Ruin was halfway down the gangplank, visible only as a ripple of disturbance moving away through the crowds.
"Excuse me, scusi, scusi-moi."
The Lyceum stage front reared up, dark against a sky stitched all over with stars as bright as moth holes in an awning. The curtains billowed and filled in the soft breeze as if they were breathing. The crowd quieted, sensing that things were about to begin. They all knew the story of the play, for it was based on the old legend of the astronaut Neil Strongarm, who flew to the moon in Apollo's fiery chariot and won the love of the moon goddess. What they were wondering was how could the Persimmon Company fit a fiery chariot and the moon's white gardens onto that tiny speck of stage?
Well, not at all, thought Ruin, not unless he was quick.
He flung himself up the steps at the backstage entrance and fell through the hatch into the bustle and commotion within. The air was thick with the smells of grease paint and armpits. The tiny, stuffy corridors a maze of shadows and confusion, lit by bobbing lanterns. Alison Froy was kneeling at the shrine, saying a pre-show prayer to the goddess Rada, who was supposed to watch over all theatre people. As Ruin dodged past her, Mad King Elvis of America loomed out of the darkness ahead of him, with his rhinestone armour all aglitter, and his vast black wig grazing the passage walls on either side.
"Oh, this is just too beastly, darling," he complained. "It's a disaster. This would never have happened if we'd stuck to using oil lamps and reflectors. Why did AP ever agree to let the girl electrify us?"
Ruin squeezed past him without answering. Cosmo Lightly always found something to panic about before curtain up. He passed Dimphner and Lilibet too, who were complaining in whispers that their careers would be ruined, and then Fern, who was to play one of the ladies-in-waiting in scene two, and was busy practising her single line.
"Yes, my lady."
"Yes, my lady."
"Yes, my lady."
In different voices, with her toy dog, Noodle Poodle, for an audience. He scrambled down a companion ladder and ran aft past the wood stacks and through the engine room, where the big boilers slept in silence and the batteries hummed. Then along a tight passageway and into the cramped burrow beneath the stage where Fever Crumb was waiting for him. And where Fever was, everything felt calm, even when it was a minute past curtain and not a footlight or a spotlight or a backstage glim lit anywhere in the Lyceum, and you could hear the crowd outside starting to make that mumbling, sullen sound that comes off disappointed crowds, and the heavy footsteps of Master Persimmon crossing and recrossing the stage above your head as he paced about, waiting to begin his first soliloquy. Fever came to meet him, lighting the way with the flashlight she had made for herself. She took the wire and smiled a thank you at him. She was fairly new to smiling, having been brought up among engineers who did not approve of it, and she wasn't really very good at it. She kept her lips tightly closed, and her mouth went down at one end and up at the other. Some people might not have recognised it as a smile at all, but Ruin knew what it meant. He stood there feeling proud and happy, holding the flashlight for her while she went to the open fuse box, her clever fingers unwrapping the precise length of wire that she needed and twirling it around and around till it broke off the coil. She had already stripped out the blown fuse. She wrapped the wire around this terminal, then around that, making a bridge for the electric particles to swarm across, while Ruin watched her. She was 16, tall and bony, with a strange face that was all angles, and large, watchful eyes that didn't match, one grey, one brown. Her hair, which she punished with a hard brush every morning and scraped back into the tightest of buns, was every shade of fair from white to honey, and her old grey linen shirt and canvas trousers were smeared with oil and grease and stained with sweat. In Ruin's opinion, which no one ever asked for, him being only 10, there was no one in the world as lovely as Fever Crumb. She glanced at him with a little frown, as if she wondered why he was staring at her, then reached for the lever on the wall that turned the power on. Anyone else would have crossed their fingers for luck at that moment, or said a prayer to Rada, but not Fever Crumb. She knew that crossing her fingers couldn't affect the universe, and she was always telling Ruin and his sister that there was no such things as gods or goddesses. But Ruin couldn't help himself. He crossed as many fingers as he could behind his back where Fever couldn't see, and he said a prayer as well, not just to Rada, but to the gods of far-off London too, Poskett and Mad Isar and the Duke. The lever came down. The dim red working lights winked on. From outside came a noise like a big wave breaking, and Ruin realised that it was the sound of the audience applauding as the curtains suddenly flamed blood red in the glare of Fever's lights. Few people in Maida had ever seen such lights as those before. The knowledge of electricity had survived from ancient times before the downsizing, but like all the old knowledge, it was spread unevenly. Great cities such as London had buildings made of stone and salvaged plastic and lit at night by electric lanterns. But on the wild Atlantic coasts of the World's End in those days, you were more likely to find grass-roofed huts and tallow candles. In some of the settlements that Bargetown had visited that season, people thought that its land barges were magic and were wary of approaching too close for fear of the demons they thought they heard a growling and a griping in their engine rooms. The Maidens were not so primitive as that, but they had a distrust of technology, and they mostly did without engines and devices. They had never seen anything like the clean, bright light that burst upon them as the Lyceum opened its curtains. The light grew brighter still, illuminating a stage dressed as a castle, with purple-headed mountains painted by Fergus Bucket and Ruin, stretching off into a smoky distance. A wind was blowing. That was Max Froy standing in the wings, huffing into a conch shell and fanning dead leaves across the set. Clouds sailed across the painted sky, thanks to an invention of Fever's own, a disc with cloud shapes cut in it spinning in front of one of her floodlights. Dappled by their shifting shadows, Neil Strongarm paced the battlements, a figure out of legend, sprung to life, looking slightly older than most people had imagined him, but splendid nonetheless, with all those trails and skerlicues of melted-down copper wire gleaming on his armour, and the gold visor on his helmet shining in the glow of the extraordinary lamps. Awed, the audience fell silent as he began his first speech. Fever and Ruin, crouched in the crawl space beneath him, had other surprises in store. Tall jars full of salt water surrounded them, each with an electric terminal in its base and another dangling into it on a wire. Electricity flowed from one terminal to the other through the water, completing a circuit that kept the lamps alight. But night was meant to be falling in the play, So while Cosmo lightly entered and started to tell Sir Neil of his plan to conquer the moon, Ruin pulled a cord that raised the dangling terminals higher and higher up inside the jars. With more water to flow through, the current grew weaker, partly spending itself as heat. The jars steamed. Up on stage, the light grew dimmer and dimmer. Cosmo raised one rhinestone arm and told the astronaut,
"So, go you, good Sir Neil, to the moon, and tell its guardian goddess even she must to good King Elvis bend her knee."
Then Fever flipped a switch that turned on a masked spotlight and threw a perfect crescent moon onto the sky above the cardboard parapets. Crouched between the simmering jars, she heard the audiences sigh and knew that she'd astonished them again. That pleased her. Unlike Ruin, she'd never fallen for the magic of the theatre and still thought that plays were so much silly nonsense. But she hoped that maybe there would be someone out there in that crowd who would be more moved by the brilliance of her lights than by the silly love story unfolding under them, and would look into electricity for themselves and come to see how simple it was, really, to generate and harness. Then she would have played a small part in restoring science and reason to this backward portion of the world. Or maybe that was just an excuse. A kindly lie, she told herself, to help her deal with the fact that Fever Crumb, trained in the ways of science and reason by London's Order of Engineers, had spent 2 years travelling across Europa on a mobile theatre and helping its crew of actors stage their foolish shows. She switched on her flashlight to check her crumpled copy of the play script, even though she knew the show by heart. There was a short scene, front of curtain, with Max Froy as the clown, before Neil's strong arm climbed aboard the fiery chariot when the red spotlight and the fire effect would be required. Time to fetch a cup of water from the pail in the corner. If the Maidens liked her moon, then the fiery chariot should really please them. Yes, it was an unlikely job for an engineer, but she liked to think that she did it rather well. Chapter 3. Strange Angels. After the show, there was a party. There was always a party after every show. When she first came aboard the Lyceum, a refugee from London with two newly orphaned children in her care, Fever had been shocked at the way the crew stayed up so late after each performance, drinking and laughing and telling again their well-worn stories of previous shows. But like so many irrational things, she had been forced to accept it. Something about the performances left the Persimmon Company elated and filled with energy. If they had gone to bed, they would not have slept. They needed to meet their audience and be told how wonderful the play had been. They needed the praise and approval of strangers the way ordinary people needed food. Fern and Ruin loved those gatherings. They liked to listen in on grown-up conversations that they only half understood and play excitable games with their friends from other barges or with the local children. New friends whose languages they might not even speak and whose names they would forget tomorrow or next week when the theatre packed itself away again and Bargetown moved on. But Fever always stayed at the edge of the talk, a little apart, careful not to meet anyone's eye in case they assumed that she was inviting them to praise her, which she found embarrassing, or just to talk to her, which was worse. She did not want to have to tell them that she came from London, and then go again through all the weary stories about the new Lord Mayor and his strange plans to set the city moving. She did not want to hear people tell her that she had the most remarkable eyes and bone structure, and to have to explain that her mother was a Skriven mutant. The worst thing about the parties was the young men, who would watch her across the crowd and then come sidling up to ask her if she wanted to dance with them, or go out for a walk or a meal. She was getting tired of explaining that she was an engineer and had no interest in their foolish mating rituals. That night she waited until the moon was well past its zenith before she called Ruin and Fern away and took them, complaining, to their bunks. All the way to the tiny cabin that they shared, they kept telling her that they were not tired, no, not the least bit tired at all, and might they not stay up for just 5 minutes more? But they could barely fit the words into the spaces between their yawns, and their eyelids were already drooping while they brushed their teeth.
Still protesting, they scrambled into their narrow bunks. Ruin curled up on his side. Fern snuggled down with Noodle Poodle, and within a few minutes they were both asleep, quite untroubled by the din of voices and a squealing fiddle that Fever knew she could not hope to sleep through. She went softly out of the children's cabin and slid the door shut. She felt no qualms about leaving them alone. They were theatre children, and the whole company was their family. If they woke and needed anything while she was gone, they could go to Mistress Persimmon, or Lilibet, or Dimphner, or Alison Froy. Meanwhile, what Fever needed was fresh air and silence. She went into her own cabin to fetch her coat. The white engineer's coat that Alison Froy, the Lyceum's costumier, had made to replace the mud-stained, blood-stained, ripped and sodden red one Fever had been wearing 2 years before, when she first came aboard. Then she climbed out of the barge and set off into the streets behind the harbour, climbing steadily up long stairs and steep, cobbled alleyways. It was never really very dark, not at this time of year in these latitudes. The stars were out, but beyond the harbour mouth, the western sky was cobalt and indigo, the sea a milky blue. Fever did not mind darkness anyway. She had better night vision than most people. To her, this was a good time for sightseeing. The city of Maida was bowl-shaped, built on the inside of a gigantic impact crater that rose from shallow water a few miles off the bleak coast of the World's End. Fever had had plenty of opportunity to look at the outside of it as the Lyceum and the other barges came down the coast road and crossed the causeway, but once they had passed through the fortified cleft in its eastern wall and entered the city itself, she had been too busy preparing for the show to look around, and had only a confused impression of rows and rows of houses stretching up all around her toward the ragged crags that crowned the crater. Now, as she climbed alone through its steep streets, she kept stopping to look back at the fresh views of the city that revealed themselves at each level. From a few levels up, she could see that the harbour that the barges had parked beside filled most of the crater floor. Fishing boats and pleasure yachts clustered thickly in the inner port, while big ocean-going galleys and caravels were moored in a deep water basin near the harbour mouth, which was a natural cleft in the crater's western wall. The buildings that lined the harbour side were old and shabby and crammed close together. Warehouses, chandlers' stores, the pinched homes of the Maiden poor. Higher up the crater walls, the buildings were bigger, spaced well apart in their steep gardens. Bridges spanned the goyles and gullies of the cliffs, and some of these had houses built on them too, with baskets on long dangling ropes let down to haul up groceries and visitors from below. Highest of all, way up where those weathered crags stood dark against the stars and white birds veered on widespread wings, Fever could see the turreted mansions of the rich perching on Maida's heights. An interesting city, she decided, and strangely familiar, as if she had seen it in a dream. She wondered if Auric Godshawk had ever called here on his travels. She climbed on, walking quickly, glad as the noise from the barges and the harbourside taverns faded behind her. On the quiet mid-level streets the night was still, the air scented pleasantly with the soft perfume of fruit trees. Garlands of blossoms decked the statues of the sea goddess that stood at every corner and street crossing, watching Fever pass with seashell eyes. Through an archway, she caught a glimpse of the midnight sea and turned toward it along a narrow footpath that led her through the crater wall and out into moonlight and the soft black shadows of pine trees on the island's outer slopes. Fallen needles underfoot, a silvery smell of resin. The path wound upward to an outcropping of stone and another weathered statue of the goddess. Fever stopped there, looking out at the sea and the zigzag dark line of the causeway linking Maida to the mainland. She thought again of the way the Lyceum had crept along that causeway earlier that day and of all the other journeys she had made aboard it, from town to town, settlement to tiny settlement, across the vastness of Europa. She had never meant to come so far. When she first boarded the travelling theatre, she had not intended to stay. She had planned to get off at Chunnel and find her way home from there. She had only joined up with the Persimmon Company to buy herself a little time to think.
She had done her thinking during the 2 days that it took the Lyceum to trundle south along the packed chalk surface of the Great South Road. Sometimes when it broke down, she busied herself helping the company's technomancer make repairs. His name was Fergus Bucket, and he resented her until he saw how good she was with the old engines. But mostly she sat in the sunlight on the open upper deck and watched the Weald and the wild chalk hills edge by, and tried to come to terms with everything that had happened. She had recently learned that she was half Skriven, and that her grandfather had been the tyrant, Orig Godshawk, whose disturbing memories, implanted in Fever's brain, had only lately been erased by a blast from an electromagnetic gun. Fading fragments of them still lingered, as ungraspable as the memories of a dream. Sometimes, superimposed on the passing heath, she would catch glimpses of landscapes Godshawk had known, the ice hills of the north, and the far-off countries he'd sailed to in his youth aboard his schooner, the Black Poppy. And if that were not enough for her to deal with, she had 2 children to look after. Fern and Ruin were newly orphaned. She was afraid that they might not be safe if she returned them to London, and also that they might encounter their dead father there, for he had been reanimated as a stalker warrior in the army of London's new ruler, Quercus. They were still silent and stunned with the shock of losing him, and she did not think they could cope with the idea that his body was still up and about. Channel was a trading port, built at the easternmost end of the English Channel, where the shallowing waters finally petered out into marshes and saltings. It was a linear city laid out on the remains of a gigantic tunnel that had once linked the Kingdom of UK to the Frankish shore, back in the ancient days before the North Sea drained away. There were tech shops everywhere, ships and land barges from all over Europa, and a babble of excited gossip about the fall of London. News had reached Channel far more quickly than the lumbering Lyceum, and Fever soon learned that the takeover had been peaceful, and that the new rulers had announced a strange plan for the city, which was to be rebuilt as a gigantic tracked vehicle. The merchants of Channel were already loading land barges with all the scrap metal and old tech they could find, eager to go and sell it to Quercus before he came to his senses. And Fever could have scrounged passage home aboard any one of them. But when the moment came, she found that she did not want to go. She did not want to go home to Dr. Crumb, who had pretended for all the years of her growing up that he was just her guardian and not her father. She did not want to go home to Wavy Godshawk, the mother she had only just met, a beautiful, arrogant, Skriven technomancer who regarded the laws of physics as vague guidelines and normal human beings as her natural inferiors. She did not want to go home to a city that was about to be torn down and rebuilt on wheels. She knew that scheme was not really Quercus's idea, that it had been devised by Orig Godshawk and passed on to Quercus by her mother, and that, like all things connected with the Skriven, it was touched with madness. She did not want to go home to see her sober, rational friends, the engineers, getting caught up in the excitement. And again, there were the children to think of. She had had no idea how to care for them, but Ambrose and Laura Persimmon knew, and so did their daughter, Dimphna, who had red hair and a face like an entertaining horse, and played crones, maidservants and comic parts, and Dimphna's friend, Lilibet, who was plump and pretty and played the younger romantic heroines. It seemed unfair to wrench Fern and Ruin away from these irrational but kindly women when they were just beginning to trust them. But what use would I be aboard the Lyceum, she asked herself, while she watched the company prepare their stage that day in Channel. She could help with the engines, but she could not act or paint backcloths or sew or do any of the other things that she saw the actors doing. But that evening, when the play began, she realised what she could do to help the company. The play itself meant nothing to her, a lot of irrational nonsense, she thought it, all about love and jealousy and magic and other things that didn't matter or didn't exist, or both. It was performed the same way such shows had been performed ever since mankind first started to recover from the downsizing, by the dingy light of a few dangling lanterns and a line of oil lamps mounted along the front of the stage. There were some crude reflectors made from those chrome-plated dishes known as Hobbs caps that were dug up by the 100 from ancient sites, but they did little good.
It wasn't just a fire risk. It was a strain on the eyes. And Fever, who had once helped Dr. Staling electrify Godshawk's head, knew that she could make a huge improvement. The next morning, she wrote a letter to Dr. Crumb explaining that she had been offered a position aboard the Lyceum. AP, as everyone called Ambrose Persimmon, was delighted by her idea of electric lighting, which he said would help the Lyceum to stand out from all its rivals. Even Dimphna and Lilibet grew quite enthusiastic once they realised that they were not going to be electrocuted in their beds. Fergus Bucket gave the plan his grudging blessing, and that afternoon, Fever went with him and a purse of AP's money to Chudnell's Tech Exchange, where they started buying the wires and bulbs and switches she would need. While she was there, she gave her letter to the master of a London-bound barge. She had regretted it as soon as the barge had gone, and she had missed Dr. Crumb badly for a few days afterward, and often since. But she knew she had done the right thing. She wanted to make her own life and her own discoveries, far from the never-ending madness of London. There was a rustle and a flutter, and something came down through the pine branches and landed on the cliff path, just behind her. She thought at first that it was just her coattail she had glimpsed, flapping from the corner of her eye. Then it fluttered again, and let out a sound, and she turned, realising that it was a large bird, and that it had just spoken to her.
"Snacks?"
it said.
"Please, snacks."
Fever stared at it. It stood there in the moonlight, a pale and dirty bird the size of a big gull. Its head was too big. Its wings hung like a ragged cloak. A long tail trailed in the dust.
"Please, lady, my snack,"
it rasped. Fever had met talking birds before. She knew a barge town parrot that could swear in 26 different languages, but she had never heard before of seabirds being taught to mimic human speech. There was something uncanny about the way this one looked at her, its eyes shining with the reflections of the sinking moon.
"Snacks?"
A dim memory came to her. Perhaps something she had read in one of the old books at Godshawk's Head. Or perhaps a memory of a memory she had inherited from Godshawk himself. Anyway, she knew what these white birds were called. Angels. Loris sapiens. They were a species of mutated gull left over from the time of the downsizing. It was said that they had evolved a sort of intelligence. Pixar of Thelona, writing 200 years before Fever's birth, had claimed they had a language of their own with over 200 words. But the spark was fading in them, and now they had only enough wit left to hang around human settlements, eating scraps and singing crude songs in exchange for food or liquor.
"Snacks?"
said the one on the path, hopping closer, hopeful. "Go away," said Fever firmly. She waved her arms at it. "I don't have any snacks." But now there were more of them, ghosting down through the shadows beneath the pines all around her on outspread wings, calling out,
"Snacks? Drinky? Pleasey, please?"
and making other sounds, snatterings and rasps and chatters that sounded like words too, but words in a language she had never heard. She heard their droppings fall, spattering on the needled earth between the trees. 10, 20, maybe 30 of them, hopping toward her across the rooty ground, absurd and unsettling like wind-up toys. One landed on the trunk of a tree beside her and went scrambling down it, and she saw that there were small white bony fingers on the leading edges of its wings. She felt them pluck at her coat as she turned and started to push back through the flock toward the archway in the crater wall. "Let me go!" she said, becoming a little alarmed. The angels disgusted her, but she also felt a queasy sense of pity for them. She, too, was a remnant of a mutant race that had flourished briefly and declined. Another of evolution's pitiless little jokes. She wondered if these beggar birds were capable of understanding what their ancestors had been and what they had lost.
"I have nothing for you!"
she shouted, starting briskly back along the path the way she had come. The angels followed. She heard them complaining at her, wheedling, the breath of the breeze through their feathers as they spread their big wings and glided after her. A good thing they were not predators, she thought, uneasily. Something white and wide-winged came down out of the dark above her and almost hit her head, making her yelp and duck as it whisked past. It made a papery sound as it cut the air. "Go away!" she shouted, frightened now. But it was not an angel. Intrigued, she watched it glide down into the bushes by the path, then blundered through long grass and nettles to the place where it had come to rest. It was roughly bird-shaped, but no bird, made out of paper and glue and slender wooden struts. Smaller than it had seemed, its wingspan no more than the width of her two hands. The thin body weighted at the front with a bronze coin. The tail split like a swift's. A small kite, she thought at first. But it had no string. It was a glider. She turned, scanning the heights of the crater above her. Light showed in a few buildings way up there, and the moon lit up pale stone revetments at the edges of farming terraces. She could see no sign of anyone who might have launched the glider. Angels blew like blossoms across the darkened slopes. She called out to them as she made her way back to the path. "What is this? Where did this come from?" The angels had already lost interest in her. One, scuffling among the bushes near the path, glanced at the thing she held and said,
"Thursday."
"Thursday? What does that mean? What about Thursday?"
"Thursday. Thursday. Try to fly."
"I don't understand." Far down the slope, where the crater side steepened into cliffs, one of the other angels had found some carrion, or the remains of a picnic. The rest clustered around it in a squabbling cloud, begging for scraps. The one Fever had been talking to lost interest in her and took flight, beating its big wings once as it went past her and sailing down to claim its share of the feast. Fever looked uphill again, held up the glider in case its owner was up there looking for it. "Hello?" No answer. Only the distant bickering of the angels, the soft snore of the sea. She looked down at the thing in her hands. It was no toy. Even by moonlight she could see how well it had been made. And that place there between the wings, was not that where a pilot would lie if the whole thing were made 20 times bigger, big enough to carry a human being aloft? In her girlhood, she had often heard old Dr. Collihole, her fellow engineer, describe his dreams of flight. She had even flown herself in the balloon that he had built from scrap paper and filled with hot air on the roof of God's Hawk's Head. She had listened to him recount the legends about heavier-than-air flying machines built by the ancients and dismissed them, sadly, as mere fairy tales because all his experiments had led him to believe that heavier-than-air flight was impossible. But it seemed to her that someone in Mitre did not agree. Someone in this city was designing a flying machine, or at least a glider. And now a model of it had flown into the hands of one of the few people in this quarter of Europa who could understand what it was. Which seemed to Fever to be such an unlikely coincidence that she did not think that it could be a coincidence at all. But whoever had launched the glider from those dark terraces above her, did not seem to want to show themselves. And it was late, and the moon was dipping behind the shoulder of the crater. And so, clutching the white glider to her chest, she went walking thoughtfully back into the city. The angels had lost interest in her, but from the shadowed terraces above, someone watched her go. Chapter 4. An engineer calls.
"Look," said Fern, "that house is moving."
It was morning, and the light of the rising sun was just starting to slant into Mida. The company did not usually rise at such an hour, but AP had decided that the backdrops and props looked weather-worn and needed to be repaired before the Lyceum opened its curtains again that evening. So, one by one, the bleary-eyed actors and actresses were rising from their beds and making their way up the companion ladders to the open upper deck, where Fever, Fern and Ruin were eating breakfast and trying to ignore the breeze that flapped their napkins about and speckled their clothes with croissant crumbs. Cloud shadows scudded across the harbour and the bright house fronts on the western side of the city.
"Look, Fever, a moving house!"
"That is an optical illusion, Fern," said Fever patiently. She was feeling thick-headed after her late night on the cliffs and did not have time for Fern's make-believe. "It is the shadows that are moving, not the houses."
But then she turned to look where Fern was pointing and saw that the little girl was right. High up on the crater's western wall, where the ground was so steep that even the Maidens had not tried to terrace it, a large house was descending gracefully through a long vertical garden. As it went down, so the building next to it went up, windows flashing in the sunlight. Farther along the cliff, another pair of houses did the same, and as Fever looked quickly across the city, she saw that dozens of structures were in motion.
"See!" said Fern, with great satisfaction. She couldn't recall ever proving Fever wrong before.
"The locals call them funiculars," announced A.P., coming up onto the sun deck in his dressing gown, a mug of coffee in his hand. "I remember them from when Mistress Persimmon and I last came to Maida, more years ago than I care to say. Mansions, restaurants, whole hotels on the smarter levels move up and down the cliffs."
"But for what purpose?" Fever asked.
"Oh, just for the fun of it, in the case of the restaurants and hotels." A.P. slurped his coffee and watched the buildings rise and fall without much interest. "As for the rich men's mansions, well, their masters like to rise each evening into sunlight and clear air, then descend again at dawn into the city's heart, where they do their business."
Fever shook her head. Mobile theatres, mobile mansions, mobile fortresses? Why were the people of her era not content to live in places that just stood still? Was it the same urge that drove the nomad empires on their ceaseless travels and had made her grandfather dream of fitting wheels to London? Was it a leftover from the downsizing, when plagues and earth storms had kept the ragged remnants of mankind forever on the move? Maybe, deep down, people just didn't feel safe if their homes were anchored to the earth. It was deeply irrational. And yet the Maiden funiculars were fascinating. She sat and watched as more and more started to move, whole neighbourhoods sliding up and down the crater walls like the shuttles of some enormous pointless loom. She wondered what it would be like to ride in a funicular, and thought again of the glider that she had brought back from her midnight walk. She had imagined that Maida would be a backward place, but so far it seemed full of wonders.
"Fever," said Ruin, nudging her. "There's someone calling for you."
Fever looked at him and realized that the annoying noise that had been intruding on her thoughts for the last half minute was a human voice, and that it was shouting,
"Miss Crum!"
A.P. went to look over the handrail at the edge of the deck. Fever joined him. Below, on the cobbled harbour side, she saw a man in travel-stained blue robes and a broad-brimmed hat looking up at her.
"Miss Crum," he called when she appeared. "Miss Fever Crum of London?"
"That man was at Master Squinter's stall aboard the Stone last night," said Ruin.
"Here, Fever,"
said Lilibet, coming to join the growing crowd at the handrail.
"That chap was here last night after the show, asking after you. Dead good-looking he is. I told him he should call again today."
"Oh, you didn't," said Fever. Lilibet and Dimphna were always trying to find her a boyfriend and never believed her when she told them that she simply didn't want one. She frowned down at the stranger, wondering how she could get rid of him. But just then, he pulled off his hat. He was good-looking, which of course meant nothing to Fever, but his head was as bald as a sea stone, and that did. She'd grown up surrounded by men who looked like that. She had looked like that herself until she came to live aboard the Lyceum and let her hair grow.
"Miss Crum," the stranger called.
By his accent, she guessed he came originally from one of the Scottish city-states, a refugee, perhaps, from ice-drowned Edinburgh or Aberdeen.
"May I speak with you?" he asked. "I am Dr. Avery Teal of London. I arrived just yesterday aboard the Rolling Stone. I'm on official business. I was delighted to learn that I am not the only engineer in Maida."
"An engineer? Here?" "He's lying," thought Fever. She had grown up among the Order of Engineers in Godshawk's Head, and she was certain that she had never seen Dr. Teal before. Then she recalled that Godshawk's Head had burned, and that 2 years had passed since she fled London. "Wait here," she said to Fern and Ruin, and she hurried down the barge's winding companionways and out through the stage-left hatch. The stranger stood waiting for her. He did not try to shake her hand, an irrational, insanitary greeting, but made a small and engineerish bow. "You don't know me, Miss Crumb," he said. "I'm a recent member. Quercus needs all the engineers and men of science he can get to help him transform London." And what true scientist or engineer could resist the chance to help set a whole city moving? "I did, for one," thought Fever, and then wondered if that was what Dr. Teal had meant, that because she had turned her back on London, she could not be a true engineer. She blushed, and felt suddenly ashamed of her hair and the odd cut of her coat. But Dr. Teal was smiling kindly at her, and she saw that he was not rationally dressed himself. No doubt he had travelled far and had learned, like Fever, that an engineer's standard sometimes had to be adjusted out here in the world. "I watched the play last night," he said. "Enjoyed it hugely." "It is a foolish story," said Fever. "The moon is 240,000 miles away. It's most unlikely that the ancients could have flown there, and if they did, I'm sure they did not find the goddess Selene waiting for them. Nevertheless, it makes a good play. And your lighting was ingenious. The smoke and flames when that chariot took flight." Fever thanked him, and glanced up at the curious faces of her friends, which were ranged along the handrail above her, waiting to see whether she would hit it off with her gentleman caller. For a moment she thought of asking him aboard, but she felt suddenly wary. How would Fern and Ruin react to this reminder of London, and all that they had lost? And what would Dr. Teal make of the chaos and clutter backstage, of the shrine to Rada, dusty with the ash of incense sticks? The engineer seemed to sense her unease. "Perhaps you would like to walk down to the harbour with me," he suggested. "There is a place nearby that serves fine African coffee, or boiled water if you prefer." It was unsettling for Fever to meet a fellow Londoner, having turned her back on London so decisively. On the other hand, it was not often that she had a chance of talking with someone truly rational. She waved up to her friends and called, "I'll be half an hour." "Take all morning if you like," urged AP, "but make sure you're back in time to run through the lighting arrangements for tonight. I'm making some changes to Act 2, Scene 3, and my soliloquy just before the first act curtain could use a little more illumination." Dr. Teal was already turning away, putting his hat back on to shield his shaven scalp from the sun. Fever did not take the arm he proffered, but walked beside him away from the Lyceum. Each time she glanced up at him, she found him watching her with a look of faint amusement. So after a little way she stopped glancing up, and kept her eyes on the cobbles instead. Crumpled programmes from last night's production blew about underfoot, and beneath a nearby barge a pair of angels were squabbling over a dropped pie. "Are you to be long in Maida?" he asked. "Only two more nights. Then we're to travel south to Meriam, where there is some sort of festival. We shall return to Maida for a longer stay after that."
"Ah, Meriam," said Dr. Teal. "Yes, they celebrate the summer tide in great style down there. More of a carnival than a festival."
Carnival or festival, it didn't seem to Fever like the sort of thing two engineers should be discussing, so she said, "I hope that all is well in London."
"Oh, yes," agreed Dr. Teal. "At least it's some months since I left, but everything was proceeding according to plan when I last looked. You'd scarce recognise the place, Miss Crumb. Everything south of Ludgate Hill has been cleared to make way for the new forges and factories, the rolling sheds, the furnaces. Night and day the new factories roar and rumble, belching out their smoke. While I was waiting to take ship at Brighton Harbour, I could see the glow of London lighting up the sky from 50 miles away. And all the roads in that part of the world are crammed with landhoys carting materials Londonward, and the sleepy south coast ports like Brighton and Channel have come alive again with cargo ships. Quercus has had to construct steam-powered warships to keep the convoy safe from pirates. It will be some years yet before the city moves. But already he has transformed the world."
Fever said nothing. She did not like thinking about London's transformation.
"Your father is well," Teal went on. "He is busy, as we all are, doing good work. He speaks of you often. I wish I had known that I was going to run into you.
I would have offered to carry a letter. And what of the other engineers? Ah, well, we're a guild now, not just an order. You can imagine how that pleases them. And my mother? Asked Fever. Wavy? Oh, she's well enough. There was something odd about the way he said it, and she saw something knowing in his expression that she did not quite like, but didn't understand.